we must be about to launch into having two people married, because that's usually where you hear this. I've come to realize, I've done a lot of weddings over the years. I did a few here, and I've come to realize that there's a couple things that you can always count on at every wedding. One of them is you can always count on a stressed out bride, because, I mean, it's a really difficult day and there's a lot happening, and, you know, the wedding is kind of a culmination of a lot of different things that have been taking place for months and months. So I realize for a lot of the women that I see at these, you know, at these wedding ceremonies, it's not a fun day for them until they're actually up there, right? I mean, it's a lot of stress when they're, like, getting dressed and making sure their makeup's okay and everything's going to happen the right way. Once they're finally up there, it's okay. But, you know, you can always count on that. I think another thing you can always count on is you can always count on the cake smush, right? The reception, and both people kind of smash the cakes into each other's faces, and it's funny. It's not unexpected, but it happens every single wedding. I think the third thing you can expect is 1 Corinthians 13. I mean, that's pretty much a standard. I think every wedding that I have been to and that I have been a part of, we've read this at some point, whether it's the sermon, whether it's a scripture reading, whether it's something else, this has come out. And because of that, I mean, this is one of those passages that you don't have to be a Christian to know this passage. Matter of fact, I mean, I could give you the first two words and you could probably start, you know, reciting it, even though you've never memorized it. I mean, it's that familiar and it's that common. The funny thing is that for a lot of us, I mean, we hear this and we use it at weddings because it sounds beautiful. It's poetic. It sounds perfect. But, you know, for the church at Corinth, it wasn't beautiful. Matter of fact, when they heard it, it's like daggers to the heart. You know, it was painful. It was challenging. It was difficult to hear. And for them, it wasn't a comfort. When they were reading Paul's letter and they got to chapter 13, it wasn't comforting at all for them. It didn't bring them a sense of peace and joy. It was actually very difficult for them to hear. And so for us, what I want to do is I want to go into this passage and I want to try to look at it to some degree the way that they did, in the hopes that it's going to challenge us. You know, for the last, basically last 2.5 months, we've been going through the book of Ephesians, and we finished off the series. But basically, we've been talking about the church, about the fact that the church has a purpose, that God wants the church to be a place where the gospel is being grown and where the gospel is going out from. You know, where if unbelievers in an unbelieving world looked at the church, they could see God, they could see Christ. And today, I wanted to just kind of generally kind of continue the theme as we looked at this passage. Because I think it ties into a lot of those areas, and this idea of love applies to us not just as individuals, but it applies to us as an entire church. And so we're going to, as we go through 1 Corinthians 13, we're going to look at it slightly differently, and basically I think this is what Paul addresses. I think the first thing he tells us about the preeminence of love, you know, that love is incredibly important. And you can hear that through, you know, what he's already said and how we've already read it. Second thing we'll see through 1 Corinthians 13 is we're going to see the power of love. And of course, you know, for my kids, I had to use that because we've just seen Back to the Future like 4 times in the last 2 months. So that had to be one of the points, is, you know, Paul talks about the power of love, because there is a sense of power, something it does. And the third thing is we're going to see the persistence of love. You know, at the end, Paul says, love never ends. Of all these things, faith, hope, greatest is love. So we're going to see the persistence of love. But as I mentioned, the first thing that we're going to address and look at is we're going to see the preeminence of love. If you go into verse 1, it starts out very, very straightforwardly, and Paul says this. He says, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all that I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned but have not love, I gain nothing. Now again, this sounds, you know, sweet and it sounds syrupy, but it wasn't for the Corinthians. It was actually very painful. And I need to kind of give you a little background about Corinth and about the church that was there at Corinth. Corinth was actually a very, very interesting place. It was actually a very important hub in the Roman world. It was a place where it sat on the spot. If you look at the map, it actually sat on the spot that was central, that if you drew trade lines, it would spoke out to major sections of the Roman Empire. And so it became a very, very powerful, very, very influential place. It was a place where merchants would go to trade, and so economically and business-wise, it was incredibly important. It was a booming city. It was a global city where different people of different cultures, different places were coming in. We saw the fact that it was not only Romans, but it was also people from Asia, Eastern Asia, that were streaming in. And so it was a very diverse culture. It was very urban in that sense. And it was becoming a place of the arts. It was also becoming a place of spiritual importance. You know, there was a strong Jewish community. There was this Christian community that was growing up in there. You also had the Romans and their beliefs. You had Eastern Asians coming in. And so it became this incredible place. As a matter of fact, a lot of commentators liken it in a lot of ways to being a lot like a city like Chicago or like New York in our day. You know, that it was a place that was economically important, artistically important, spiritually important, it was a very, very unique place. And because of that, the church was a very, very unique place too. I mean, it was probably more diverse than most, and it was a church that was filled with not just different kinds of people, but different types of people. People of wealth, people who were successful, who were influential, people who had talent, visionaries, you know, people who were highly successful. And what's interesting, the reason why I bring all that up, and the reason why this passage is so painful, is what Paul begins to do when he starts chapter 13, is he's writing to a church that is incredibly gifted and incredibly talented, but they're not very loving, they're not very mature. And what he does is in the first three verses, he actually points out everything that they are. You know, so go back and listen. He starts in verse 1. He says, "If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong or clanging cymbal." Now, one of the things that we know about this church is it was a place that had this, you know, there were a lot of people who had these great spiritual gifts. You know, the people who spoke in tongues, people who prophesied. In verse 2, you know, he says, prophetic powers. He says, "If I have all knowledge, if I have faith so as to move the mountains but have not love, I am nothing." He's addressing something very directly. Again, they were spiritually gifted prophecy, but they were also, from the outside, they looked like a spiritually strong church. That looked like they had strong leaders. They had a solid ministry. Matter of fact, they were probably a church that was running church conferences, that was doing worship DVDs, that people were like studying and finding out about, that, you know, they were on the radio and on TV, that everyone on the outside said, "Wow, that's a great church." I mean, they were visionary leaders. I mean, this incredible stuff that was happening from looking on the outside. And then verse 3, you know, they were also generous and sacrificial. He says, "If I give away all I have, deliver my body up to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing." I mean, this was a church that was generous. I mean, they gave out of their wealth. They gave to different churches, different areas out of their wealth. And apparently, I mean, they were passionate. They were people who were willing to put their lives on the line for the faith. But Paul notices something. You know, from everything that Paul's heard and everything Paul's experienced, is he notices that there's this underlying immaturity, this underlying immorality. And what he begins to notice is all of that flows from one place, the fact that they are not a very loving church. And so what Paul does, and the reason why it's so painful, is as Paul begins to say all these things about even if you have this, but you don't have this, you're nothing, everything he lists is everything the church would say about itself. I mean, that's painful, right? I mean, you know, here's the church reading this letter, and it begins to see all these things that they puff themselves up over, that they say, "This is what makes us such a strong church." And Paul says, if you have that, but you don't have love, you're nothing. Even if you have these great things happening, but you have not love, you're nothing. I mean, what he's doing is he's tearing them apart. And, you know, the reason why he's doing it, what he's trying to get at, what he's addressing, is the fact that he's not instructing them, he's not encouraging them, he's rebuking them. This is a church that's supremely talented, that it's incredibly gifted, that is doing great things, but it is a church that's devoid of love. And you know, for most of us on the outside, we would die for a church like this. And we would die, we would kill to be in a church like this. You know, a church where it seems like so many different things are happening, one where you look at the leaders and they seem to be so gifted. You look at the people, they seem so spiritually mature, so spiritually gifted. And we look at the types of outreach that we're doing. You see people who are so generous, giving of their time and of their energy and of their resources. But what Paul pushes is this idea of the preeminence of love, that all those things pale in comparison to love. You know, that's a very important thing for us to hear and for us to remember. Not just because we're a small church, but for any church, that's an important thing. Because you know what? The honest truth is that you and I and almost everyone else, you know, we perceive the church to be those other things. You know, I know for me, you know, I've been a pastor for a long time, and I know for me, like, when I get together with other pastors at different places, like when I go to Presbytery or when I go to General Assembly or when I'm just kind of hanging out with guys that I know or pastors, I know that a lot of times we talk about the same things. You know, you meet someone who's pastor and we'll say, oh, how big's your church? What kind of ministry are you doing? And you know, even for pastors, I mean, those are kind of the measures of a ministry. You know, what's the size? And what types of things are you doing that are working, things that are successful, things that you know, that no one else is doing or that you're doing better than everyone else? And that's a very, very easy way to rate a church or to see a church or to understand a church. And Paul says, that's not what God sees, and that's not what matters. Now, does that mean we shouldn't care about those things at all? No, we should care about them. We should want to do good ministry. We should want to see people coming. But he says there is something that is preeminent, and that is love. That what matters for a church doing church, that what matters for people doing community is love. That you can have ministries set up, you can have meetings set up, but at the very heart of it, if people are coming in and they are not sensing, they're not experiencing love, if you are around people and you are not experiencing that, then what is really happening? And that's a huge challenge to us, isn't it? It's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge because it's easier to program ministries. It's easier to program meetings. It's harder to love. But Paul says that's what's important. That's what matters. That's what needs to be looked at. That's what needs to be done. And even for the most talented, the most gifted churches, they can build monuments to their faithfulness. They can do great things that everyone sees that says, wow, look at them. But if they do not have love, if they're not doing love, then it's nothing. Again, what Paul is doing is he's not instructing them. He's rebuking them. And, you know, that's a great thing for us to look at, you know, to ask ourselves, are we becoming a people? Are we becoming a community of love? Are we loving people? Are we serving people? Are we taking the time and effort both on an individual basis and on a corporate basis? Are we doing things that make people feel loved? And then we get away from those questions of how many people are coming, what types of ministry are we doing? How can we love people? And you know, I'll tell you this, just as we were talking about in the book of Ephesians, the reason why this is important is because an unbelieving world needs to see a church that loves. That is far more powerful than when an unbelieving church sees a huge mega church or sees a church that is doing ministry all over the place, that's going across the globe. When an unbelieving world sees a church that genuinely is loving, it makes a difference, whether it's small, whether it's a big church, whether it does a lot in the community, whether it does very little. When an unbelieving church sees love, love is convincing. So that's really the first thing we see. We see the idea that Paul is trying to show them that the most important thing is not gifting and talent, it's love. And that a lot of times, in a weird way, gifting and talent does not reveal the heart. That what's important is love. And again, you know, hopefully as a church, we take that to heart. Second thing we see is we see the power of love, and there's kind of two pieces to that. I've already talked about one in the sense that what Paul is doing is he's rebuking the church. He's also challenging the church here in Corinth to be loving. And the idea that he doesn't state directly that we find out in his other letters and we see through the rest of the letter in 1 Corinthians is that there is a sense in which love has a power. When we become a church that loves people, then that really makes a difference in people's lives, both people on the inside and people on the outside. And that's one of the reasons why when he describes love, if you notice, he talks about love in a relational sense. He says love is patient. Well, in order to be patient, you need someone to be patient of, right? It says love is kind. Again, that's relationship. In order to be kind, you need someone to be kind to. You know, so there's a lot of things in here that when he says this is what love is, it's relationship. And the implicit idea is that when, you know, there's a power to love, that when we love people through patience, kindness, goodness, all these things that he's talking about, it's transformative for them. Whether they're believers or whether they're not believers, it's transformative. If the person isn't a believer, then as we love them, they draw nearer to Christ, they come into community, they become more of who God wants them to be. And if they're not a believer and we love them in these ways, it convinces them that God is real. And that doesn't mean that they're, you know, that they're absolutely going to convert. But love has this power. And you know, we've experienced that before too. I know when I wasn't a believer, I remember one of the things that made me really think about whether I should become a Christian was, you know, a few of my friends who were believers and watching them becoming, you know, one of my friends I grew up with in high school, junior high and high school, and I remember when he became a Christian, I mean, he changed, not drastically, he was a nice guy before that, but I mean, I saw these changes happening in him, and he became this. Again, he was always kind, but his love became different. And that was one of the things that first kind of caught my attention that started me thinking of, should I do that too? I mean, there's this incredible power in love that when you love someone, when someone sees love coming from you that's not what everyone else does, when they see that you care about them and that you're willing to give up your good for their sake, there's power in that. You know, in those moments and in those actions, they see the goodness and the glory of God. And the neat thing is that you don't have to be an evangelistic type. You don't have to hand them the four spiritual laws. As you love them, they begin to see that. And so that's one sense in which love has this incredible power. I mean, think about what our world, our society says. You know, our society doesn't look at Christians and says, look, they're so loving. For a lot of people in the society, they look at Christians, they say, hypocrites. But what would happen if they looked at Christians and said, wow, Christians are so loving? I mean, it would be a part of what convinces them. And there is this incredible power behind loving people, the sense in which when we love people genuinely, when we love people with God's love, it is transformative for them. It begins to move them. It begins to change them. Without them even knowing, it begins to shake things around in their heart. There's another thing that it does, and this is going to take a little bit more time to kind of work through, or it's going to take a little bit more detail. But I want you to look at verse 5. Okay, so take a look at verse 5, and Paul does this interesting thing. He says, very end of 4, you know, love is patient, kind, does not envy, boast, is not arrogant or rude. Verse 5, he says, it does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. Now, there's some discrepancies in how that part is interpreted. It says it does not insist on its own way. Some people kind of view it the way that it's translated here and says that love is selfless, and that's true. Another way that you can translate it is other translations use the word self-seeking. It is not self-seeking. Some of you might have seen that word or that phrase or the way that that's kind of described. And basically what it's saying here is it's saying love doesn't just transform the other person. You know, when you are patient with someone, when you're kind with someone, when you're not arrogant with someone, when you're not rude, then it changes them. And that's one part of the power that it has. What Paul is saying, though, is that somehow love also transforms us, right? That's what he's talking about. He's saying, you know, not only do you act love out towards people and it changes them, you know, he says, it does not insist on its own way. He's talking about the fact that there is a sense in which love changes us. In other words, see, what Paul is doing is he's not just commanding people to love. In order to love, you need to be transformed by love. And that's what he's talking about. He says, love is not self-seeking. Now, I want you to think about this for a second. This is a very interesting kind of point that he makes. You know, what he's getting to is absolutely true. He's telling us that it's love that will transform us, love that will change us. One of the biggest problems that we have is sin. I mean, that's, you know, if you've been at church for any measure of time, you know that we talk a lot about sin. But I want to ask this question. At the very heart of it, what is sin? Right? Think about that for a second. And there's, you know, historically, there's a couple different ways people have wrestled with it. Augustine said this, and this seems to be the predominant notion, is that Augustine said, essentially, at the heart of sin is selfishness. Sin is self-centeredness. Sin is putting yourself before everyone else. Sin is putting yourself on the very throne of your life so that you are king, you are commander, you are the authority. It's your voice you listen to. And I think he's absolutely right about that. Now, think about this for a second. Why does sin make us selfish, self-centered? And why is that the absolute heart of what sin is? Well, if you think about it, sin is rebellion, right? It's rebellion against God. What is the primary way that you and I rebel against God, who is creator, who has created all things, who is the total and complete authority over all things? The way that you and I rebel against God, the way we rebel against his rule, the way we push him off his authority is we say, I am the authority. God, you are not king, I am king. Lord, you are not in charge of my life, I am. My life is about me. That's how we do it. The way we throw God off, the way we, at the very heart of sin, what we do is what selfishness, what self-centeredness is it's rejecting God. And when we reject God, we need something else to be the very source, the very center, the very key thing in our lives, and that's us. And you know, we see that in children, don't we? From the very moment they're born, they want life to be about them, right? That's why they cry. That's why they complain. My life isn't right. Give me food, right? My life isn't right. I'm still awake, right? And that's what they do. That's sin. You know, sin is selfishness. It's self-centeredness. And you know, that's what we see in Genesis 3. In Genesis 3, we have Eve. She's told, Adam and Eve are told not to eat from one tree. It says, you can eat from every other tree. One tree, don't eat from this one. What does she do? She looks at it, she goes, oh, looks so good. Oh, looks so good. Looks beautiful. I would love to sink my teeth into that. And what does she do? She changes God's words. She justifies. She says, God doesn't know what he's talking about. God told me to do this, but I listen to me. I decide how my life goes. So she takes and she eats. See, at the very heart of sin is selfishness, self-centeredness. And that's what's in the will of every child. And that's what happens through the teenage years. You know, a lot of you don't have teenage kids, but as kids become teenagers, they find different ways to say, no, I'll do it. I'll take care of myself. I'm my own person. And you know, the reason why a child does that, the reason why a teenager does it, is because a child instinctually knows, if I need you, then I have to answer to you. And that's what we know too. That's one of the reasons why we try to throw God aside. Because if we need him, we know we have to answer to him. And that's one of the reasons why selfishness is at the very heart of what sin is. Because selfishness is a way to say, God, I don't need you, so I don't have to listen to you. Don't have to obey you. Don't have to trust you. Don't have to do what you say. I live for me. And you see here what Paul is saying is that not only should you be a loving person, in order to be a loving person, you need to be transformed by love. You need a love that will come in, that will shake you to the very core. Because you know what? The truth is, we're just like the child. You know, a lot of us struggle still with selfishness and with self-centeredness. And for a lot of us, we think it's just we just think it's a discipline problem. It's not. It's not. The reason why you and I still struggle with selfishness and self-centeredness is because we are still secretly at war with God. That we still want to say to him, I don't need you. Even as Christians, we want to say, God, I don't need you. I can take care of my family. I can take care of my life. I can take care of me. I make the decisions. And it's because secretly we don't want to listen. We don't want to obey. And we don't want to trust God. We don't want him to be our authority. It is a battle to believe in God's grace. And you see, what the church needs, what we need, is before we can go out and love, before we have the capacity to love people the way God wants us to love, we need to be people who are transformed by love. We need to be people who have been so shaped by love that our insides are different. To such a degree that we are no longer selfish, we are no longer self-centered, because the love of God has reached us. And that's a huge, huge challenge. I mean, that takes a long time. That's not something that happens, you know, in an instant. But it is something that begins to happen the moment you're saved and in stages throughout your life. That throughout your life, if you're someone who wants to grow, you see in fits and in starts, you see ways in which you are self-centered, ways in which you're selfish. And in those moments, you also see ways in which God, though you were selfish, gave himself for you. And in those moments, it opens you up, and Christ's love changes you, transforms you in those moments, and you become more like him. The third thing that I wanted to address, and we'll kind of close out with this idea, is Paul also talks about the persistence of love. You know, he talks about the preeminence of love, how love is the most important thing. Talks about the power of love, that when we are loving, it changes other people. But before we do that, we need to be shaped and changed by love itself, and that comes from God. Third thing we see is we see the persistence of love. And basically here, you know, again, you know, we do see that Paul is calling the church to, the church in Corinth and us as a church to be more loving. You know, he is saying in here, hey, you know, you should be patient, you should be kind, you should be kind. You shouldn't envy. You shouldn't boast. Shouldn't be arrogant about things. You know, all those types of things. But at the same time, there's something else going on here, and I do want to address that. There is a problem with this entire passage, and the problem is this. The problem is that if this passage is just about Paul saying this is what you should be like, then for you and I, when we read this passage, we should actually feel despair, because we can't do this. I mean, think about it for a second. He says, love is patient, love is kind. And sure, we can aspire to that. We can work towards that. But honestly, you know, if we were to look at it and put ourselves into that picture, I mean, we aren't. And to some degree, it doesn't matter how where you are on the scale of how patient you are. I mean, in the broad brushstrokes, you either are or you aren't. When Paul says love does not envy or boast, it is not arrogant or rude, I mean, for you and I, we should look at this and we should feel horrible, because we don't live up to this. Paul says, does not insist on its own way, and right there, I mean, that destroys me, because we're selfish, we're self-centered. It says, it is not irritable or resentful, does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Again, things that I am not, that I'm guessing a lot of you aren't either. And then here's where it gets really hard. Verse 7 and verse 8 says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. Now, there's something kind of going on there, and I think it's this. I think what Paul is doing is kind of twofold. He is telling us that we should be more loving, And I think that's kind of the obvious thing that we kind of pick up from this. The other thing that he's doing, and I mentioned this in the previous point, is I think he's showing us the love that will transform us. In other words, when Paul is talking about what love is, when he's giving us this description, he's not just saying, hey, church, you're not like this, but you should be like this. I think especially when he gets towards the end, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things, love never ends. I think what he's doing is he's trying to point us to the only love and the true love that will change us, and that's the love of Christ. And when you think about that, I mean, let me read it again, and it begins to make sense. You know, Paul says the love of Christ is patient, it's kind. Now, his love doesn't envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude, does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable, resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. The love that Jesus has shown us bears all things. It believes all things. It hopes all things. It endures all things. And his love will never fail, and it will never end. See, Paul is telling us that we should be more loving, but he's also telling us about the only love that will truly transform us. And that is the love of Christ. He's giving us this picture of what love is. But that love that he's explaining is love that only Jesus has shown in the entire history of the world. Only Jesus has shown that love. And so for us as a church and for us as people, he's telling us to be that, but he's telling us the only way we can even try to be that is if we have experienced that first in Christ. And you know, that is a powerful, powerful thing to hear. What Paul is doing is he's giving us this beautiful picture. And he's reminding us that it's on the cross that Jesus loved you with a never-ending, never-failing, always and forever love. And when you know that love, then that is the love that will change you, that will transform you. The congregation, the church that was at Corinth, was gifted. They were talented, but they were also arrogant. They were immature, and they were immoral. And the funny thing happens, when you go into 2 Corinthians, Paul's second letter to them. In the first one, Paul is harsh. He points out their sins. He calls them to the carpet about their immorality. In the second letter that he sends, you begin to realize that they've changed. Why have they changed? How have they changed? They've changed because of love. Love has turned them from being rebellious, from being immature, from being immoral, to people who are now faithful, who are following Christ and faithfully doing his will. You know, what you and I need is you and I need a love that will transform us. And unlike what the world says, that love will not come from your spouse, that love will not come within your family, and that love will not be given to you by your friends. The love that you need that will ultimately transform you is the love of Christ. That when you realize how much Christ loved you, how he loved you, and how that love will never stop, that is the love that will turn you from being immature and immoral to loving God and giving your life for him. And it's that love that you need in times of suffering and tragedy that anchor you down, that remind you that no matter what happens in your life, whatever takes place, you are firmly in the hands of a God who loves you. On the cross, the most amazing thing about the crucifixion is on the cross we see that Jesus is rejected. On the cross, the Father turns, and when the Son needs love the most, the Father turns away. Why? It's so that Jesus receives the rejection that you and I deserve. And the love that Jesus deserved as being the only faithful, the only true, the only obedient Son is the love that we are given because Christ has died in our place. And when you know that love, when you know that love will never change, then it will transform you into the person you were always meant to be. Let's pray together.